the women seem to perfect love and devotion. And then to go beyond that into the like 800s and all requires almost like a testosterone-driven, one-pointed ferocity. It's a ferocity to grit and walk through the day with this agonizing, almost paralyzing pain, to act and behave normally and at the same time searching what it is in you that's out. Is it coming from out there? Is it coming from within you? Is it coming from your own karma? Is it coming from the collective? To try and track down the origin of it, you know? So I think that's what the answer is. It has nothing to do with femininity or masculinity. It has to do with, I think, just the capacity of the physical body to handle shoveling tons of coal. There are women that can do it, but not statistically. They're not the great coal shovelers of mankind, and why would anybody want to be? I mean, when you've got this kind of a body, it means you're being really called to perfect certain things. And I think some people that deny gender are really denying the spiritual reality that this gender is supposed to be teaching them, and they're delaying their own maturation. Just like the man has to learn to overcome fear in the face of death, you got to be able to walk into bullets. If you don't walk into bullets, you just don't get over a certain level. For God and country, there comes a day when you just got to walk into bullets, and that's sort of a testosterone kind of a thing, you know. The woman faces the same thing, but differently in the context of nurturance and childbirth, etc. She risks her life over and over, and traditionally the women lost their lives frequently. Childbirth fever and died in childbirth. So in my grandparents' day, they are a family Bible. You know, out of five children, three die, and the mother then eventually, then the birth of the eighth child dies. So that was very, very common. So the great risk of was the willingness to give one's life for nurturance, for continuance, out of compassion and love for one's children, and the continuation of the race. So it's just, to me, it has nothing to do with political correctness. It has to do with the obviousness of what the task would be in one form rather than another form, you know what I'm saying? So if individuals in high fives and sixes are holding up the consciousness of the rest of the world, what happens when they die? Does every level of consciousness remain within the world? Yes, I believe so. I mean, that's just my opinion. The answer to that is yes. Yes, because it becomes part of the collective consciousness of mankind. So, you see, every time you forgive someone or choose to forgive rather than hate, every time you choose mercy over revenge, this has not only a karmic consequence to yourself, but to the collective consciousness of mankind. You see, we saw the consciousness evolves, the calibrated level of consciousness of life itself evolves over time. And in this new book, I sort of track it from its appearance on Earth in the ooze. What's the calibrated level of consciousness of the ooze, you know what I'm saying? The primordial ooze. And then out of that, the most important thing was that it doesn't happen as a chemical accident. The scientific viewpoint of evolution is that life started, you know, and accidentally all these chemicals got together and in the bright sunshine and bang, you had life. But that's a category error. Life is a totally different category from chemicalness. So anyway, the level of consciousness of life on this planet has continuously gone up. The consciousness level of mankind has constantly gone up. Let's just redo the consciousness of mankind at the time of Jesus Christ, we have permission to do that, was approximately 100 resist. The consciousness level of mankind as a whole was 100. Okay, So the impact of Christ on the conscious level of mankind was to raise it dramatically. The impact of the Buddha on the conscious level of mankind was to raise it dramatically. The impact of Krishna The impact of all the great sages and gurus and saints. The impact of Mother Teresa on the consciousness of mankind is to uplift it, All right. The impact of turning over the beetle helplessly lying on its back is to raise the consciousness level of mankind, So you don't have to be a great recognized saint to profoundly affect the evolution of consciousness. So we see it's gone up tremendously, All right, we've handled most of the questions. The question is suicide. I've never checked out suicide. We ask permission if we have a, permission to check it out. We have permission to check out suicide in this audience right now, Okay. I'll give you my intuitive understanding of it. The karmic consequences of suicide are no different than that of the state of consciousness which led them to it in the first place, The physicality of it is irrelevant, So if you commit suicide because you are in a state of grief at 60, the only thing that happens is you go out of body and you find yourself at 60, So it doesn't solve the problem. Now you don't have a physical body, you're in your spiritual body, and you still got the same dilemma, which may or may not be beneficial, I don't know. People, I don't want to jump with the goal of the world's presumptions. To not have a physical body could be actually an advantage at that point, It's better to keep the physical body until its karma runs out, Okay. So if one commits suicide then prior to the karmic timing of the leaving of this physical body, you hang out in the, what do you call it?
Limbo? I don't know.
I can smell when they come around. Discarnate. Okay. All right. So you've got three more years to live, because we said the karmically the age of the body is already set. The time and date of death is already set. Let's reconfirm that. The time of death is already karmically set for this lifetime. Okay. So if you don't see it out, let's say you commit suicide 3 years before you're, let's say you're destined to die at 72 and you knock yourself off at 68. You're gonna have to spend 3 years on the other side, until that karma is over, You're gonna be a discarnate, okay. All right, so now you've got the misery that led you to do it and the physicality, the karmic commitment, I don't understand that because I've never researched it. A lot of this we're talking about is somewhat irrelevant, but it is relevant, But spiritual questions come up. Because you have a microscope, all kinds of things you wouldn't have bothered with, now you got to run and pull them out of the pond and look at them. to some degree, we're doing that. But it is a natural question. I think, yes. Okay. Praying for the individual who has committed suicide, may have permission to ask this, is beneficial to them, It is beneficial, in other words. Okay, so praying for the person who has committed suicide would be then beneficial, and they'll help them to overcome their guilt about it and all. So that's a, who was it that did a book on death, the first famous one, the German doctor, Right, and others have, I think she wrote that the near-death experiences of people who tried suicide were not any different than those who had were dying of natural causes. In other words, there didn't seem to be, in her observation or studies, any identifiable negative consequence at the time. Because what you're going to experience is exactly what you're experiencing while you're in the body. The hopelessness or desperation is going to continue whether you're in the body or the out of the body. So there's no, let's see. The karmic consequences are due to the state of mind that led to the action. Is it? All right. So it's spiritual intention that sets the karmic cost or consequence. Is it? All right. So it isn't the physicality that's important. So if one did it out of hate, out of rage, out of despair, out of getting even, out of retaliation, out of skewering somebody else with guilt. He made me do it, you made me do it, note. That's skewerism. So the extreme hostility of that. So you're stuck with the karma of the extreme hostility, which led you to try and skewer somebody else with a lifetime of guilt because you knocked yourself off, right? So we're still dealing then with the price and the quality of it all is occurring within the level of consciousness of which the physicality is then the acting out of it. It would seem, we'll ask this last question, then we'll do it, that the karma is really no worse just because one acted on it, resist. The karma is actually no worse, resist. It's already worse, that's why you did it, resist. In other words, the worstness has already happened already. That's why, so the suicide is merely the consequence of the despair and self-hatred or whatever it may be that led you to do it in the first place. So it's, again, intention that which seems to determine the karmic consequences. Mm-hmm. All right, now, we ask if there are any more questions, and then we'll go on with the lecture. If there's any more questions, we'll answer them first. Any more questions about some of the things that we've raised already?
The coming time frame for the body, can that be extended?
I never got that it was a yes. The karmic lifetime of the body, the karma of the body is already set at birth, resist. It's alterable, resist. It's alterable. Resist. Alterable for worse, resist. You can alter it for worse. increase the longevity through spiritual alignment, resist. Hmm. The lifetime would tend to be more healthy and extended just due to the energy of the spirituality, resist. Oh, I see, yes. Because the energy... We have in the audience a doctor who did a study on the relationship between spirituality and survival from serious illness, such as HIV. And very statistically accurate and very scientific from an academic viewpoint. And it demonstrated that spiritual alignment with spiritual values, and you can speak if you wish to. Anybody, you want to speak up, Doc, or not? Huh?
It was actually my sister's
study. Anyhow, the point of the study was that the longevity was related to spiritual commitment. That spiritual commitment tended to increase survival rate from any illness. And anybody who's been in a Course in Miracles group knows that, because in every Course in Miracles group, we've seen people with hopeless advanced fatal diseases, and they're still walking around, and some are at these meetings, in fact, who had very slim chance of recovering. There's some here today.
Altruistic behavior and
non-judgmentalness. Okay. Altruistic behavior and non-judgmentalness. So those are general spiritual principles, non-judgmental and altruism. the thinking of the welfare of others, the opposite of the egocentricity of narcissism, which is the infantilism, which is at the basis of criminality and all the things that hit the newspapers. So it's really maturation then, to stop thinking about me and my wants and my desires and blaming others and accept responsibility. So the altruistic person who turns over the beetle then has a much higher chance of surviving everything. And I think that's been proven with heart disease, heart attacks. It was the famous heart surgeon that wrote about it, did the first study on it. And that those people who had a spiritual orientation to their life had a much higher survival rate from coronary artery disease and every other disease. They had a much better longevity. So the answer was, yes, you can increase the longevity of the life of the body then by the sheer, what you've changed is the energy field in which it's being nurtured, yeah? Somebody had another question? Hmm? Yes?
What is your guidance for most people's tendency to keep on going into the dualistic mind?
Do you hear me?
We're living like a material, common, everyday world with all the things that comes up. Even if we start out in a very aware state, then how would you guide us from, you know, being pulled into that dualism?
What is she asking? How you escape the attraction of the world and its, huh? Oh, the dualism of the world. Yeah. Well, you don't have to be attracted to it.
You say in that unity awareness, we can be fine with doing whatever we're doing, regardless of the so-called problems that may seem to come up, right? But I think what happens is that it's just that we're so used to thinking dualistically that pulls us so strongly, and then...
Yes, there's a certain amount of spiritual work one does just on one's relationship to the world in general. The ones in us who are glamorized by it. Yeah? Most people are glamorized by it. The ones who are attracted to the sensationalism of it, the excitement of it, the drama. The society you're talking about is the ego projected out there for us to observe and learn from. So the value, and I use social examples in my writings and talks, because the ego projected out there is now dramatized on channel 15 for you to witness. So without being personally involved in it in particular, the more painless way is to witness it and learn from the observation of what is going on in society. And then you can see it within yourself and clear it. It's much easier to see it out there. So you can see the difficulties of positionality in the world and the price that is paid for it. And this makes it somewhat easier to accept in yourself that this is a natural human proclivity. We were talking about softening up the superego before you start examining yourself with a microscope in detailed, very intense spiritual work, which people eventually get into, those that are really committed, eventually you get into rather intense meditations in which every single thing is examined with great intensity. By now, you're sophisticated enough to know that that's not just a personal defect of wonderful, wonderful you, that this is the rubbing off of the nature of human society. So the society is merely a projection of the collective ego. And so what we learn by watching the news and reading the newspaper, people say, well, shouldn't, you know, there was a period of time when the energy was totally prevailing and there was no interest in the world or anything went on in the world. I never read a paper or magazine. I didn't own a TV or a radio. No idea what went on for 10 years or so. One can conversely develop an aversion to the world. So to be perfectly balanced, there's neither attraction nor aversion. One is not repelled by the world and say, oh, I can't watch TV, that's all disgusting stuff. nor can you be attracted. So the perfect spiritual balance is neither aversion nor attraction. Because you have no aversion or attraction, you don't have to avoid it. To return to the world, you can't really have any deep aversion or attraction. It isn't a matter of being detached, it's a matter of being non-attached. If you're detached from the world, which I did for a good 10 years, the world has no significance, importance, etc. You're detached. You are not involved in the world. You have no involvement in the world. Whatever it is that you become is affecting the world just by the essence of that which it is. But there is no actions on your part in one way or the other. That's the perfect renunciate. And the life of the ascetic. So for some years I was an ascetic renunciate. Never went anywhere, there was nothing to see, no social life was uninteresting. It was all irrelevant. Then there's a difference between non-attachment and detachment. So then there was a relinquishment of detachment as a positionality, as an aversion and avoidance, to see the world as a trap and therefore avoid it, which is the downside of being a renunciate. There is a time when your own spiritual reality has to be sufficiently strong that you can walk outside the cloisters and still remain that which you are. You can speak to strangers and eat food and touch people, and either mate or not mate, depending on the suitability of your lifestyle. So the detached person is a renunciate, avoids the world, and this can become itself a deterrent to enlightenment. If it's neither this nor that, then you can participate. So the person who does return to the world does so on the level of non-attachment. It would not be safe if you're still attached, because it'll suck you right back in. And that's why Ramakrishna forbid his followers to touch sex, you know, have anything to do with sex or money, because the energy, the attraction was too strong, especially at a young age. To be non-attached, then, means it's okay if it goes this way and it's okay if it goes that way. And if I see the parade, I will enjoy it. And if I don't see the parade, I won't miss it. Neutral is a very good space in which to work at that. Neutral, you're released from your attachments and your avoidance and attachments. You're pretty free. You can either stay or leave, it's okay. If we make it to the movie on time, we'll watch it. If we don't get there, we won't go. It's okay either way. You're not attached. You don't have to cry that you missed it. You don't have to get furious that your partner was fixing their hair and you couldn't get out the door in time, and therefore you missed the movie or whatever. You know how life goes with people, a daily bickering life, you know? Well, if you had hurried up, we would have made it on time. Now they've changed the price, and now it's a $4.50. If we got in there, when it's $3.50. So life becomes this little bickering trivia in which you're attached to winning and losing, and winning and losing face, winning and losing control. All right, so then at a certain point, one becomes non-attached. Therefore, to win or to lose is really irrelevant. If the other person wins the argument, great. You won the argument. Oh, you let them win the argument. Why not? It's fun letting people win. Did you ever do it? They cheat you out of a dollar 20 and think you didn't catch them. I let them have the dollar 20. Why not? You know what I mean? What difference does it make, you know? You're not attached to winning, you're not attached to losing. You're not afraid of winning and afraid of losing. You're afraid if you win that you'll get attached to winningness and get addicted, and that's what happens at the casino. So the casino lets you win enough to get you hooked. Now you'll keep coming back until you're cleaned out. So that's the attachment. So the attachments then, which we're trying to relinquish, are really coming out of the solar plexus. So everybody thinks sex is the base chakra. No, it's the attachment. It's the solar plexus attachment to that activity and what it does for your ego and your sense of satisfaction and your sense of aloneness, desirability, your self-esteem. So it's all the things that are piled into the meaning of that. So we're attached to the meaning of things, and that's why we're addicted to certain activities. So the perfect practice then, in a meditative, contemplative kind of a practice, is neither attachment nor aversion. You neither hate it nor are you addicted to it. You don't have to avoid it. If you're attached to things, then you have to avoid them. You can't have one piece of chocolate because you know you'll eat the whole box. I remember when I finally got off chocolate and I'd let go of chocolate for a long time and chocolate kept coming up. Finally, I completely lost any desire, thought, or appreciation for chocolate altogether. And I said, wow, I'm off chocolate. I'm free of chocolate. I got unhooked from Diet Pepsi years past. Now I have one can all day. So all these things you get hooked on. I remember when I got free of chocolate, it was hysterical. Because the very next night, the Course of Miracles group was coming out from New York, and they had about 40 or 50 of them in the house, and they brought this huge chocolate cake. So I didn't have to avoid it, because I wasn't going to get hooked by it again. So I could either have the chocolate cake or not have the chocolate cake. It was a great sense of freedom. I didn't have to avoid it for fear I'd get hooked on it. And the same with Diet Pepsi. I finally got unhooked from Diet Pepsi. And now I can have a can or not have a can. There was a time if I left the house and there was no Diet Pepsi with me, I had to turn around and drive five miles back to the house to get a Diet Pepsi. That's being hooked, right? All right, now if I leave without a Diet Pepsi, I don't need one. So the freedom to enjoy things then means being free from aversion or attraction. You do that through the spiritual disciplines. The major ones that you don't have to go to a guru who's 800 to get off these very important ones, you're looking at 200 to 2, you're looking how to get to 250. You're not looking how to, you don't have to have a world famous guru or something. Because this is spiritual practice to let go of your attachments and your aversions. And once you're free, then you're much quicker, you're much more free to move up more rapidly. So I think these basic spiritual things, asceticism versus addiction, all these things are very important. So the 200s are extremely important because it's really there that you go free. You see? The experience of God over here is freedom. Huh? God, experience of God, once you're over 200 over here, where is God over here? He's, well, he should be around 200, right here, about, around in here. I don't know what happened to God, it's freedom. My God view is one of, freedom is supposed to be in there. It must be on a different chart of it. About 210, you experience God as freedom. You suddenly own your own freedom, that you're free to choose. You're not hooked this way and you're not hooked that way. And God's experience is freedom. So it's sort of an exuberant state of spiritual growth when you realize that God is not vindictive. Any other questions on the subject? Here we go.
My question.
Then we'll after we finish the questions, I'll be glad to see people personally or sign books or anything. And then we're free.
My question, you talked about the karma, like it's predetermined your karma. You come in with a certain amount.
We're going to have a whole lecture where we're going to focus on it. To understand karma is a great spiritual benefit if you're a spiritual seeker. One of the difficulties with Western style religion, etc., is it doesn't really comprehend karma, nor does it realize its importance. It comprehends it in that it knows that negative behaviors in this lifetime will result in a negative consequence after you leave the physical body. So although it denies it believes in karma, It doesn't. What it really means when it denies karma is reincarnation. It means it doesn't believe in physical reincarnation. All religions believe in karma. Let me tell you differently. The whole point of religion is the awareness and the responsibility that the spirit body is going to continue along after this physicality. So if people were more aware in the Western world that every action has a consequence, a very profound consequence, and may have a very long-term consequence, then there would be greater responsibility. So those cultures which are more sophisticated as far as their understanding of karma are much more aware that every action has a consequence, and it has a long-term consequence. So we're going to do a whole session on karma. I forget the specific question she asked. Oh, yes. Because consciousness itself transcends many physicalities, many lifetimes. It goes on for eons, actually. Let's see how long consciousness goes on. We have permission to ask that. Here's us. The consciousness had gone on for eons. Resist. Therefore, we're talking about eons. This consciousness, the consciousness present in this room, has gone on for eons to reach this degree of evolution and complexity and consciousness and awareness. And there are many dimensions where no such thing goes on. There's many dimensions in which we are already would be considered masters. And there's other dimensions in which we would be considered bumbling idiots. Let's see if that's so. There are dimensions in which this group here would be considered spiritual geniuses, resist. We would be considered saints, resistant. We would be considered saviors, resist. So compared to other dimensions, this group here, we're already extremely well advanced. Compared to other more evolved dimensions, we are bumbling idiots, resist. Barely out of the cradle, resist. And in kindergarten, resist. All right. All right, so if there's an infinite number of universes, and the infinite number of universes are expanding at an infinite rate, just the mathematical probability is that there are infinite numbers of universes more advanced than our own, and an infinite number of universes less advanced. That's okay, right? That's okay. Some are ahead, some are behind. Yeah.
Yes, can you talk about how pesticides, drugs, and demineralized food affects a person's ability to care about seeking truth?
That came as a result of an experiment, which we've done a number of times in this country and others. We don't have time to do it today, but if you take two apples, one, you don't know which is which. And I say, everybody look at this apple, the whole crowd goes weak. And I say, look at this apple, the whole crowd goes strong. We know experimentally that the consciousness knows which one has the pesticide in it. It's been done blind on us as well. When we were in Korea, we were handed two packages of green stuff, and she said, let's have the crowd calibrate on it, you know. I didn't expect it wasn't programmed, she just came up with it. And so we did. And the one bag of greens, I think it was cabbage, made everybody in the crowd go weak, and one bag made them all go strong. And the one that made them all go weak was a pesticide, just like the apple experiment. So that's what leads to her question. If merely looking at it, picking up on its aura can make you go weak, then what in the world would be the effect of ingesting that stuff for a lifetime? And what would be the effect on a whole civilization such as ours, where everybody's stuffed to the gozzle with pesticides? Scary, right? We have permission to ask about this. We've never asked about this before. I get what it is. The negative energy of the pesticide compared to one's spiritual power is extremely weak, resist. Oh, yes. See, positive energies, that because you're looking at the law of the rhythmic progression, the fact that you're kind to the person next door is so powerful that a little bit of pesticide doesn't really kill you. In other words, the negative is so weak. If it weren't for the fact that the negative energies are weak, mankind would not exist. We said 85% of the people on the planet calibrate below 200. If their power was equal to this, the planet would have exploded millions of years ago. All right, so the negative effect of the pesticide is so weak. All right, so it's like one zillionth of an ounce of the negative. And just one loving thought as you pass an old lady on the street, you just sort of, your heart goes to her, has already negated all that. So if you're very loving and pure in heart, you can need a lot of pesticides. That is a fact, resistant. It's just like smoking doesn't affect some people at all negatively. Resist. Yeah. It's just because the chemical effect is so small compared. That's why 15% counterbalances 85% resist. Yeah. All right, so pesticides do affect us negatively, because we can demonstrate, and we could do it again in this audience, that merely looking at it makes you go weak. But that, of course, is a kinesiologic response in which you're trying to decide whether that's above or below 200. That doesn't tell you how much power it has. It may make you go weak, but it may be very, very, very weak. Huh? So we don't have to be afraid of it, what I mean. In other words, our positive energy is so powerful that we can handle a little negativity without going down the drain. Be a good thing, or none of us would be here. We'd all be killed just by breathing a couple of breaths of air or drinking the water. So perhaps some of the environmental fears they're correct but exaggerated. They're given far more power than they really have. Because man, if he changes his mind about something, can totally shift it. Enormous amounts of energy and power. And the negativity is too weak. What?
Your chest x-ray. You have to tell them that.
What?
Your chest x-ray.
Oh, the chest x-ray.
Yeah, are you going to tell them that?
Oh, they're not interested in that.
Yes, we are.
Yes, well, we were saying yes, that positive thinking is good for you, right? Yes. Well, anyway, my own chest x-ray has never been too great. I had aviary tuberculosis, which is incurable. You get it from birds. And the chemicals that cure regular tuberculosis don't cure aviary. But anyway, for $12,000 or $15,000 worth of multiple medications, all of which makes you nauseated, after a year you got a 30% chance it may cure you and save your life from aviary tuberculosis. Or they could surgically take it out and do both, to which I said no. And then there was all kinds of scarring, atelectasics. I've got multiple x-rays over the years, you know. And I thought, so if you die of aviary tuberculosis, I mean, who cares? It beats being run over by a truck, you know what I mean? You got to go somewhere. People forget about, you know, this running after longevity is when you block this hole, the water's going to have to find another hole out. You're going to have to get off this planet some way, folks. And if you don't go this way, you're going to be forcing yourself to go this way. You know what I'm saying? If it's not a truck, it's going to be a harpoon, or it's going to be an earthquake, or see, cancer is something. I mean, you're going to force yourself out of here some way, because nobody stays here permanently. So it's only a matter of your choices. So anyway, I told the guy, no, I'm not going to do that. And so they did a biopsy without anesthesia. We tried bronchoscopy without anesthesia, which doesn't work. Because the physiologic response, you can't control it. And so anyway, after all this drama, I'm sorry I ever saw a doctor in the first place. I really am against seeing doctors, to tell you the truth, because you have one thing wrong with you. By the time you leave there, you're a wreck. You've got anemia, and your cholesterol's too high, and geez, now you're an invalid. You're a walking invalid. You're scared of your diet. You can't have a cheeseburger anymore. Every cheeseburger is killing you. Oh, it's horrible. Your life is down the tubes. Well, anyway, so if you want to spend all this money on all these drugs and be nauseated for a year you got a 30% chance it'll cure it, or you can just croak. I said, I'll croak. Goodbye. So anyway, I just did a little bit of processing on it. I didn't do much processing, really, actually, come to think of it. No, I quit resisting it. That was it. Neither aversion nor attraction. I thought, well, I'm not going to be attracted to dying of it because it's nice to get out of here. And neither am I going to have an aversion. So I did neither attraction nor aversion on it. Well, then I had to have a chest x-ray for some chest x-ray. Oh, yeah, because of migraine headaches or something. He said, well, it could be cancer of the lung and it's gone up to your brain. Oh, that's true. And see what you get from me. I mean, there's places where doctors are handy, but as a general rule, could be cancer from the lung. You're a smoker, so you got cancer of the lung, it's gone up to your brain, and this is giving you. So we'll get an electroencephalogram, we'll get a skull x-ray, we'll get, what else, what was I going to tell? Yeah, a chest x-ray, right. So anyway, the chest x-ray came back perfect. Everything that was in the chest is gone. No scarring, no tumors, no tuberculosis, no atelectasis, no fibrosis, nothing. Clear. That was just 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. Yeah. You know, it doesn't make any difference one way or the other. And if God asked me, I'd say, look, I mean, I thought, I really want to finish this book. That's really what I want to do. And so I felt a little guilty that I wasn't taking positive action. I said, if this knocks you out before you've got, maybe you've got some karmic obligation to do this book, and you're going to have to come back all over again and do this book now. So those are the mind games that your mind plays with. And then you realize that that has nothing to do with reality. But apropos of what we were talking about, healing this, I'd forgotten about that whole thing. You know, that was a whole drama in itself to about those things. So I feel sympathy for anybody who's going to doctors and getting any kinds of diagnostic treatments and all that, because I know what's involved. Not only that, but it's very boring. You sit in doctor's offices forever. Not a one of them can be on time. Don't they own a clock or what? I mean, you know, in my office, they got an appointment at 10, 4 after 10 is as late as I make them wait. You know, you can sit in the doctor's office and 2 and 3 hours goes by. So it's a heck of a way to blow your time. I don't advise sickness as a way of resolving psychological problems. I really don't. And I tell everybody, no matter what's wrong with you, go do the Course in Miracles, and after you finish it, then come back and see me about it, you know, because there's no point in wasting physical time on that which merely cures itself when you're willing to forgive yourself and everybody else. And so I think that's the end of the questions, all right? And then we'll meet with anybody who wishes to meet, and I'll talk to anybody personally. We have one more question, and then that's it. Oh, yes, okay.
We did the before already.
Okay, let's just see. Let's do the change, so I don't remember what the number is. This group has gone up over 2 points during this lecture, over 3 points, over 4 points, 5 points, 6 points, 7 points. Goes up 7 points, 8 points. Some people have gone up over 20 points, and some people over 30 points, yeah. The group as a whole usually goes up around 5, 8, 9, 10. Today was 9 points as a group, but some within the group made major jumps. So
20.
Yeah, 20 points. That would be 5 points a lifetime, 4 lifetimes. Just certain information itself, the reason I like to share it, is just the information itself already has a benefit. If you know that you cannot experience your own physical death, it's not possible. Instantly leave the body just as the animal does as the physical death occurs, and you are the witness of the physicality of it. Nobody can experience their own physical death. It's not possible. You'd have to be there. And you're not there anymore, so how could you experience it? You know, it doesn't even make sense. To know that is a relief. To know that the time of your departure is already preset is a relief. Why worry about it? You don't have to worry about it. It's all preset. You might as well have a good time, enjoy yourself. If that's set, the calibrated level of consciousness is already set at the time of birth. You're already born at whatever you start out at. So you don't have to feel guilty that, you know, you're not a genius. If you're born with an IQ of 82, you're going to learn what you can at 82, because that's what you're supposed to be doing at 82, is learning how to spell. So we accept that which we are. We say, we give thanks to the Lord that these are many things that are taken out of our hands, that they would be a great burden to us. And we thank thee, Lord, for taking on the responsibility of our life, our human life, our appearance, our departure, and our ultimate destiny. Om. We did Om, and we saw that it calibrated much higher than pronouncing it differently. Consequently, we'll go Om. And I thank you all. Thank you.